Ken Olson was so kind as to take us on a personally conducted tour of parts of his plant, beginning up where module boards are assembled and working down to the testing areas for several of the models. We think you'll catch the sense of vitality and action which the entire digital equipment organization exudes. Located in Meenor, Massachusetts, in a former textile mill of American Woolens, probably one of the better ways to set up a growing company, because space is certainly not as expensive as it would be in a brand new facility, yet the facilities for expansion, particularly in the Northeast, which has declined in the textile area, these are unexcelled.
The old mill has been really great for us, and even though we're building new buildings now because it's not practical to expand the old one, it's hard to get people to move to new buildings. We've built or will soon have finished 1.5 million square feet in Massachusetts, and we have to draft people to move to the new buildings. They rather stay in the old mill. This building we're just leaving was built for the Civil War. The South had all the advantages when the Civil War started. England and everybody else expected the North to collapse without Southern cotton. But the North fooled them by growing sheep on every patch of green grass and setting up woolen mills, and this was one of them. We use several hundred computers in our own shop, many of them in production, and many of them are generating software. Here, as you walk by, you see a room filled with time-sharing terminals, and there must be 20, 25 people in here, all working on their own problems and just sitting at a
teletype. They'd be on a PDP-10, would they?
Most likely this is hooked to a PDP-10. It turns out we do much of our small computer software development on PDP-10 because it's more capability for servicing the programmer.
I think you could get lost in this building.
Oh, yes. There's over 1 million square feet here, and it's just made up of many buildings added on and patched on. In Maynard, we do our original production of units. We'll go through the production line of where we make the modules for use here in Maynard. Most of them are made in Puerto Rico and Ireland. And a few of the early special runs are made here, but we can see how they're done. The integrated circuits and components are largely installed automatically. It was an interesting systems job to make this possible. The integrated circuits and components have leads that are large compared to the holes they have to be inserted in. There's so many steps in the way where tolerances can build up. So we lay out the boards digitally and end up with a digital tape for each hole. The digital tape then goes to the tape-controlled machines which drill the holes in the boards. That same tape then generates a template for running the inserting machines. Here's a inserting machine that has a choice of 4 integrated circuits that the girl picks the integrated circuit as it goes over the template, and it'll pick the right circuit from the bin and insert it in the board. She's just setting up her template here. In this machine, she's inserting diodes. We have some machines which are computer run. It turns out that we can't quite justify this, and so most of them are done operated by a girl, and she runs the machine through a template. The template is generated digitally, however, from the same tape that drilled the original holes in.
Each of these clonks that you hear in the background represents one diode being put in place.
The same type machine is also used for inserting integrated circuits. Overwhelmingly large percentage of the parts are installed automatically. But the large number of girls is for inserting the small number of parts that have to be inserted by hand. It's where the large power resistor the girl is putting in here.
The units which can't stand the beating they would take in the automatic machinery mostly?
No, it's largely those which aren't worth tooling up to insert automatically. We do most of our back panel wiring in Canada on semi-automatic machines. There's about a dozen of them right here. We do a small amount of the work here in Maynard. We have some fully automatic machines. At one time it cost us 20 cents a wire to do it manually, 10 cents a wire to do it automatically, and 5 cents a wire to do it semi-automatically. And so we made the large number of these semi-automatic machines, and they're run by a PDP-8. The device points to where the wire should be installed, and the girl installs the wire where it's pointed to.
With a wire wrap by hand.
With a hand wire wrap gun, yes. We find this most economical. And then a numerical display tells her what length wire to pick out of the pre-cut selection of wires. You can see she just picked the pre-selected wire now, and she installs the wire in her gun. The device points so she can hardly miss it, and the wire wrap gun will not operate unless she's in the cradle correctly. And then this is a quite traditional wave solder machine. We tend to standardize on a small number of board sizes, and we have one set of sockets, and so there are very few sizes we have to use.
Are these board sizes industry standardized yet?
No, no. And one of the things we are very happy we've done is to standardize internally to a small number of sizes. And this group of girls does the final inspection and touch-up of the boards after they've been soldered.
Can they test them here?
No. I can show you where we do the testing. When we are very small, making only 2,000 or 3,000 simple modules a month, we had a large army of technicians who did the testing. And we very early went to computer testing of modules. This was a rather major project because the circuits operate very quickly. And sampling during the transient is a challenge. We use a sampling scope, which allows us to sample during the transient. These are the setups for the manual testing. You can see we have a small number of people still doing it. And back there in the corner, we have an automatic tester. This is one of our module testers. What we normally do is the girl inserts the boards into the module tester, and if it's correct, it just types out it's correct. If it's something wrong, it types out what's wrong, and normally it types out enough information the technician can correct it immediately. And so during normal operation in the areas where we're making large number of modules, the girl just keeps plugging them in. When there's something wrong, she rips off the printout, wraps in the module, and the technician can often fix it right away.
This module tester is based on a PDP-9L. And the PDP-9s and 15s are the machines that they use internally at Digital Equipment to do module testing.
At this point, we entered a large room from which the 1105 assembly and test line was being moved to Puerto Rico.
This is the remnants of this used to be the kitting and stock room on the right-hand side.
So the assembly area for one computer model might be in a room an acre to produce 20 a day fully loaded. And are they conveyed on a conveyor from point to point?
Yes, they are. We're finally testing production of last month that is come into January. What we try to do is get every sub-assembly tested before we go into this test. In other words, we've tested the memory up at Westminster, the modules in Puerto Rico, the power supply in Springfield or in Canada or here, wherever we built it, and we've also checked the backplane wiring online over on the conveyor belt. So what we're doing is bringing the central processor, the memory, the power supply, and the front console together and running computer-controlled diagnostics off of the 11 mother station here. All the diagnostics and tests are stored on the DISPAC, which is a 2315 DISPAC. The main computer station is called the mother, and these are all the daughter stations.
So you can support how many of these daughter stations out of the 11?
Well, 20.
This is a 20-unit-a-day assembly operation and test operation.
That's right. Now, what happens is, we run all the diagnostics at room temperature, and we make sure the computer is good and it runs, and any of the repairs, of course, are put into the cycle over there. We then put the computer in its heat box and heat it up to 50 degrees centigrade and go through the diagnostics again. The heaters are inside there in those big resistors.
And the diagnostics are saying something.
Just running a test through memory. It probably runs worst-case patterns. It runs the double checkerboard and its complement, and it tests 17 tests on the central processor.
Do you get many machines which, when delivered to the customer, are found to have a fault?
Our goals are to ship machines with less than a 1% failure rate, and the 1105 is currently doing that.
Yeah.
What you can see also from the front console here is these are light-emitting diodes on the front console. We've replaced, even in the lowest-cost machines, the incandescents with light-emitting diodes, and We expect the failure rates, of course, to be very, very low, and we found that to be true.
Those are single-unit light-emitting diodes.
Now you want to marry it to a system before you ship it, and that's what happens. These machines go down here and go on the shelf.
And do you assemble with peripherals before you ship?
Always, if the system calls for it, if the order calls for it. Here we're headed towards the old environmental area.
Interesting.
Now, what happens here in this test before we go on, this is a bus simulator, and once in a while we'll check it with more tests than the mother station could put on to make sure of bus compatibility throughout the life of the computer.
Does this simulate I/O units on the bus?
Yes, right up to the interrupt capability of the machine, as fast as the bus is.
Now here
is the environmental chamber, and what this does for 48 hours is cycle between 25 and 50 degrees centigrade and run diagnostics online. In other words, these machines are operating, and they're running diagnostics, and they're seeing the temperature cycle.
On 100% testing of
it. On 100% testing of the machine. If they fail, they get another 48 hours.
And that ages them properly.
It gets what they call infant mortality.
Each PDP-11 goes in a box. It's about a foot by 2.5 by 3 feet. Just the thing to put under the Christmas tree.
Here's where we're building a system for the laboratory market. It's called the GT-40. It's a combination of a keyboard, a graphics scope called a VR-14, a light pen, and a PDP-1105 computer. And it's associated software. There's a real-time clock, etc. And with this, you get the capability to do graphics in the lab. If you add a analog-to-digital, digital-to-analog box to this, you've got a full graphics system for the laboratory.
And would you normally use this as a remote for a larger computer if you had calculations to do, or does it stand alone?
This stands alone. Eventually, we will have a high-speed serial line to the larger computer.
What do you program in?
Real-time BASIC. This is the laboratory peripheral system that marries to the GT40. There are 8 channels analog input. There's a real-time clock. It's variable. And the given output with, relay capability, et cetera. This combined with the scope and light pen is a full graphics system.
So this essentially is a turnkey type of application where you provide a package that includes a certain number of components and software support. Is that right?
That's right. It takes the user about 90% of the way. He has to, of course, hook up his instruments and do the special programming that his instruments require. But with real-time BASIC and these laboratory peripherals and the scope, he's 90% complete by the time he has the system installed.
What's the little display in the front for?
That's a little decimal readout that shows you the given levels that you've set.
So that for his analog signals, he doesn't have to translate bits on the 16-bit pattern, whatever.
No, it'll read it out digitally, and it'll give a given level. And it's, of course, calibrated 5 millivolts, 10 millivolts, 20 millivolts, 100 millivolts.
We were to learn that these mini-computers have very rugged frames.
You can see this box at 1105, feel how heavy it is a double-bottom, really rugged frame all around. One of the demonstrations our people here in production do when customers worrying about reliability, they take a computer unit off the floor, kick it down the stairs, and plug it in again, and it always works, and you can see why. So we're willing to pay the price for a rugged box and rugged construction because we discourage it, but people do misuse the equipment.
So they charge by the pound, but most of the weight is the frame.
This is a sample demonstration area for the MUMP system, which was originally developed by Mass General Hospital for information collecting and accessing in hospital systems. It's a database system, so you add to the database and interrogate the database in a simplified way. And it's still used largely in hospitals, but also we sold one to the Israeli shipping line.
Flexible enough to accept various kinds of database formats?
Yes, yes. And so this is a demonstration area, and you see the large number of telephone lines coming in.
These configurations are hardly what one might call mini.
That's why the definition of mini gets to be so awkward.
The game, I sometimes think, is find the central processor.
Indeed, that's the problem. Now, when organizations or countries want to develop a computer capability, they always want to build a central processor. Normally, that's
really quite unwise, because the biggest contribution they could make is taking some other part and make an original contribution rather than follow what's already been done. Here we do the engineering for some of our peripherals. Here we do the life testing on our wire printer, and you see this is set up for this large spool of tape and large spool of ribbon. And here's the life testing for the ribbon mechanism.
This printer prints at what speed, Ken?
30 characters a second, character at a time. It's one row of wires.
So it scans across the character.
That's right. 5x7 now. The line printers we buy outside. Well, here's the cassette unit. You can see there's two cassettes in a panel. And somewhere we can find an open unit to show you how simple it is behind it. These are two DC motors. One drives the one spool directly, and the other one drives it with a step-down pulley.
So you've got the fast speed and read-write speed.
That's right. And you see it's on a heavy casting, and everything's quite rugged. This is a half-inch compatible tape unit. It's a relatively straightforward, simple, not high-performance unit, but does have vacuum buffers to make it reliable and easy on the tape. The high-performance tapes, which we sell on large computers, we buy those outside. This is a high-speed paper tape reader and punch that we manufacture. Actually, the internal punch we buy outside, and the reader we make ourselves with a stepping motor. And that's the unit which we sell on most of our small computers. Here's the movable head disk. It's a single disk package that's removable, and the actuating mechanism, and then the electronics to go with it.
The voice coil type actuator, which is the fastest mechanism that people are using. Disk is a way of life in the computer industry, and removable disk also seems to be a way of life. Does this machine have fixed as well as removable surfaces?
No, this one has only the removable surfaces, and we also have a fixed head disk with a plated surface. This is the fixed head disk. We plate these ourselves. This is the advantage of the metal disk, is that they're coated with a very hard surface, I think rhodium, and so they can tolerate rubbing and with no detrimental effect at all. Because of this, you can run them very close and get very high density. And because they're plated, it's easier to get uniformity of plating.
This is an in-contact type of recording,
no.
What they call?
No, they're floating, but we can tolerate contact. And in this clean room, we assemble the fixed head disks with the plated surfaces.
Are they hermetically sealed?
No, just very tightly sealed.
You don't make your card readers and punches yourself, do you?
No, we don't. We sell relatively few. Most of our things are tape-oriented. So those units we do use, we buy. This is the cathode ray terminal device we're now selling.
What kind of technology do you use in the keyboards?
It's a capacitive-operated...
Not a switch contact.
Encoded. Not a switch contact. Encoded by this large-scale integrated unit here. And then we have several small... input terminal devices, which people use in factory applications. This is the enclosure we use for very severe industrial environments. You can see it's hermetically sealed, and it has a heat exchanger or air conditioner built into the door, and everything is completely enclosed in its own environment. It should pretty much tolerate any external environment.
Even sulfite paper mills?
Even sulfite paper mills, yes.
The sulfite process paper mill was one of the first examples of a hostile environment that one large manufacturer of process-controlled computers ran into. The problem with many of these industrial environments is that contacts, unless they're very carefully gold-plated and so on, will corrode and give you high-resistance contacts, which even in a digital device can cause problems.
We next found ourselves in a room stacked high with documents of all sorts.
We're preparing software and tapes and literature to go with the software and production quantities is a major problem. You can see the large room here where we store the programs and the literature to go with it, and it's a big operation, sending them out, those that go with the equipment. Often the box for the software is bigger than the computer, and then we take orders for the various software which we have available.
Most of your operating systems go out on the small diameter half-inch deck tapes, is that right?
That or paper tape, and now it'll be also on cassettes.
You've heard about the minicomputer from one of its manufacturers. Now let's look at it from a user's point of view. We've selected one out of a great many mini-computer applications talks because we believe that it illustrates extremely well the processes potential mini-computer users should and sometimes do go through in choosing from what are still a bewilderingly large array of available mini-computers. Dr. Daniel S. Diamond, an employee of Index Systems up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, explains the steps involved in selecting and deciding how to use mini-computers.
At Index, we sort of span the range of the capability and applicability of the small machine. My co-author, Richard Carpenter, who is a vice president at Index, is responsible primarily for the implementation of large-scale online systems, which is primarily the business that Index is in. In those projects, whereas the application systems themselves are intended to run on large machines, in particular 360/65 running under the time-sharing option of OS 360, the same kind of thing running under the new operating system on the 370, also running under using commercial time sharing, primarily running under the CPCMS system for the 360/67. In both of those kinds of environments, we have the problem of interfacing large numbers, in one case 6 to 8, in one case 20, graphic terminals to the system to work with the applications. To give you a feeling for the kinds of applications there, large online financial decision-making systems. So in both cases there, we have the problem of interfacing terminals with the big machine, and we're using small machines to do that, and in two ways. One, a very kind of garden variety way, where we simply have the small machine taking keyboard and eventually cursor input from the terminal and tagging it with a message to identify the terminal it came from and passing it on to the big machine, which then also decodes it to find out where it came from, and doing this in both directions. And there are a certain amount of things that have to be done in working with the 360, but that's basically a rather common kind of use. You can think of it as a concentrator controller kind of application. The other one is also the same thing, but we've extended it based on our experience so that when a request comes from a terminal and goes to the big machine, the result is often a multi-page report, and that's feasible because we're running high-speed displays. These are sometimes listings of securities, sometimes multiple histograms, scattergrams, pie charts, all of which were the result of a single request. Well, in the system that I first described, let's say that 10 pages get generated. The terminal user is forced to go back to the big machine to tell it that he's ready to see another page. And he may have pushed a button on his terminal to say that he wanted a hard copy of the previous page, but that's sort of incidental. This places a certain load on the big machine. In the second case, we've augmented that by putting a disk with the small machine so that when a report of any kind is first generated by the big machine, it's sent in its entirety to the small machine, which stores it on its disk. After the request is made, the manager only is communicating, although he doesn't know it, with the small machine, and subsequent pages, we view as a screen load as a page of the report, come only from the disk and the small machine, thereby reducing the load on the big machine. Well, that's sort of one class of use of the small machine. My responsibility at Index has been the development of a general-purpose multi-programming system for small machine and the applications that I mentioned that got me interested in the small machine in the first place. Let me give you a brief description of the multi-programming system. I think you'll see it's kind of the other end of the spectrum. It's full multi-programming using hardware relocation, which wouldn't have been available with most small machines a few years ago, or maybe last year, and most of them now, so that we have multiple programs in core. All of them have addresses relative to zero. Hardware lets us switch processes. We have a foreground-background kind of system. Background jobs range from things like a program which can be awakened according to a time-of-day check to run a program, We use that for doing certain kinds of file compression at night. An administrator can say to the system, do it at 4:15. And assuming somebody doesn't turn the machine off when he goes home at 4:15, this background job will be awakened and it will continue. We also do all I.O., things like the line printer. We're using Philips cassettes for offline storage, magnetic tape, regular industry compatible magnetic tape is also done as a background job. We have a comprehensive file system. Files can be shared. When files are shared, the kind of protection that they're shared with is a function both of the owner of the file and the user of the file. Files can be transferred from one directory to another. We have a full master file directory, user file directory kind of structure. It is a very general purpose kind of timesharing system because we wanted to be able to build numerous applications that would run under it, both from sort of a product point of view, which is what I'm primarily concerned about now, and also so that when we are basically a consulting company and when in the future we run into situations where we see a potential for an online system, which first of all could run on the small machine, and I'll talk a little bit about what kinds of things can and cannot run, in my view, on small machines, secondly, where the economies make sense, that we would have it sort of in our bag of tricks that we could pull out to use in those situations. So I think the idea of this past few minutes was to give you a feeling of the kind of spectrum that at least we see for these machines. Let me next look a little bit at the question, what is a mini computer, the way we see it? There's a lot of variability in potential answers to that question. But first of all, we view it as a general purpose computer in the sense that it has a main memory of some type. It has registers. It has various kinds of logic for doing arithmetic and other kinds of operations. Typically, the kinds of facilities that are available are less fancy than those of a large machine. Secondly, it's inexpensive. A lot of people are now bringing out what they're calling stripped machines, or they call them OEM machines, which I don't totally either understand or agree with. You can get a programmable, maybe only read-only memory type programmable, but a programmable digital computer from the vicinity of $2,000 and maybe less now. And then they sort of go up depending on how big they are and what kinds of equipment's attached to them. Another sort of class of properties is that they're more or less self-contained, reasonably portable, and very important, I think, is that they don't typically require special facilities such as air conditioning, raised floors, and electricity, and so on. Although we have found that when our building is not air conditioned over a weekend, that we really can't continue to run the machine because the cabinet very quickly gets up to the maximum running temperature. So it really does have to be in an air conditioned environment, we found, but it does not have to have special computer room type air conditioning. Well, what's the sort of the problem that we're focusing on? Given a particular application, we have to determine whether the minicomputer is an appropriate vehicle. Now, why do we think that this is an important issue? Well, we have a couple motivations. First of all, minis are cheap, and there's a tendency for people to overuse them. And the thing that's sort of dangerous about that is that low cost is often deceiving because at the same time, it often is associated with fairly minimal software, minimal manufacturer support, minimal documentation, lots of other kinds of minimals that can be very dangerous. The other kind of thing, and it's the one that I personally am more concerned about, is that they, not that they'll be overused because they're cheap, but that they'll be underused because historically minis have been used in a very specialized and limited kind of way. And in fact, the kind of way that I think we at Index are using them in the first of the two classes of examples that I mentioned. There is a misconception, and the only reason it's a misconception, I think, is that because not enough people have been involved and, in fact, tried to see what they can do, but there's a misconception that a large machine is required to do a complex task. And I think that if, in many cases, if you do some analysis of the seemingly complex task, you'll find that it can quite easily be handled by something other than the world's largest machine. Because the Mini, we think, is quite capable, and because when it can be used, it's usually a very attractive solution because of low cost, we think that it's worth doing a reasonable decision analysis whenever a situation comes up that may be a potential candidate for a Mini. We propose a very simple conceptual model that is not restricted to analyses involving Mini computers. And in a sense, we presented it at such a conceptual level that it may appear that it doesn't say anything, so that I'll try to use examples to support it. And in fact, we went through a similar kind of analysis when looking at the problem that first got me interested in Mini computers, because it was speculation on my part that it could be done, and we did a little bit of various kinds of analysis to try to substantiate that. We have a sort of a three-step approach. The first step is to view an application as making demands on computing power. One thing I want to emphasize on the first step is that you really have to view an application as a region and not a point in this space. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that's the case. But by that I mean a region is a collection of points which are alternative uses of computing resources to solve the same problem. And there are lots of examples of kinds of trade-offs that can be made. And then you can apply constraints to them, and some of them are no longer feasible, and you have that kind of problem. But the idea is not to simply say, well, this application, you know, requires this kind of computing power and this kind of storage and so on. I think you have to try to do a little bit more comprehensive analysis than that. The second step is to characterize the mini computer environment, or the computing environment provided by small machines, as another region in the same space. And then obviously the question is any part of the application, any part of feasible solutions to the application problem in the mini computer space? And I say, you know, that's a very conceptual kind of thing, but it can be used in a rather pragmatic kind of way. Let me, to make it a little bit more concrete, just sketch a few significant dimensions of computing power, which are strictly, in this case, hardware issues, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. The first one is word length. The small machines, typically these days, range, or what I consider small machines, range from 12 to 18-bit words. I guess people still call everything from 8 to 24 bits mini computer. I guess 8 is certainly in that category. The 16 these days is a very popular word length for lots of reasons. The reason word length is a significant dimension is that it's related, with most machines, to the directly addressable memory. It's related to the way in which data is represented in its simplest form. It's related to things like, in some cases, instruction set repertoires. Another obvious one is main memory size, which will determine the maximum size program that can exist without various kinds of memory management, and that's, in many kinds of applications, going to be a very significant issue. Similarly, memory access time will often be a significant issue in determining the speed at which algorithms will execute. Channel capacity, by which we mean things like the amount of peripheral processing, the data rate, the issue of asynchronous versus synchronous, the issue of independence versus dependence of data paths and so on, is important because it will determine such things as the amount of peripheral processing that can be done, the amount of information retrieval of various kinds that can be done in a unit of time, and a lot of things related to data transferring between the memory and peripherals and the user, if you're talking about an online system. Instruction set power is also going to be significant because it's the sort of basic control on the ease with which algorithms can be implemented. It'll affect tremendously, in some cases, the speed of program execution and program size. And finally, the basic architecture of the machine, having to do with things like the number and types of registers, the kinds of memory, any issues involving memory hierarchies, I/O structure, this kind of thing. And that's obviously a very significant kind of issue. And in fact, with lots of manufacturers, it's the main thing that they focus on when introducing new equipment. They're looking for new architectures as opposed to simply speeding something up or making something bigger. Let me go on from there to look at some classes of applications and their implications in terms of dimensions of computing power, what's commonly called number crunching. The main issues that we have run into with small machines have to do with things like precision, the availability of floating point hardware, in some cases main memory size, if you're trying to do things like linear programming on a small machine, you have a large problem and there's a lot of communication between main memory and a disk or some other device because you can't work on the entire representation at the same time. Another class is sort of online information retrieval, where database size is going to be an issue, and the computing power issues that are raised there are device accommodations, sizes, numbers, and types of devices that are attachable to a machine. Another issue is transaction volume. For example, if you have a machine that with disks that can access, can do 10 or 15 disk accesses a second, then you can attach somewhere between 4 and 8 of them, you have an obvious limitation on the number of data accesses that are going to be performed per second or per any unit time. And therefore, transaction volume is going to cause you to look quite carefully at that kind of issue. Memory management, which is not sort of an end application itself, but it's a kind of a task that has to go on with many other kinds of applications, is obviously going to be affected by the main memory available, overlay, and other kinds of memory management schemes that are available with the hardware or software. Channel capacity, because if you're going to have to do a lot of communication between main memory and peripheral devices, sort of the speed with which the algorithm will be executed will now depend not only on how fast it's executing in main memory, but also the amount of time that you lose from the calculation due to transferring data to and from main memory. There are a couple of observations that we'd sort of like to make on this process, and that is that given enough time, you can do almost anything with a mini, and that's sort of an unusual situation. On the other hand, if a calculation takes 10 seconds on a large machine and would take an hour on a small machine, it's not necessarily better to do it in 10 seconds if you don't have a requirement for the resulting number for an hour. And then, you know, we've ignored cost up to this point, but it's true that it's going to go both for and against minis, because minis are cheap, but on the other hand, a small part of a big machine can be rented. Now, on the other hand, it's turning out these days that the cost of that small part of a big machine is not small. It's big, but on the other hand, typically using a mini involves owning hardware, having a place to put it, having somebody who knows a little bit more about it than they'd have to know if all they had was some sort of a teletypewriter in their office. So there are other kinds of implications. It has to be taken into account, and it's not sort of obvious just because they're cheap what direction that'll move you in. The main reason we focus on hardware is because it has kind of limiting properties, as we've discovered in a couple proposals that we've done. We thought that we could save somebody about $11,000 a month, and then we discovered that doing floating point calculations in very large quantities on a small computer makes it not so obvious that we could save them all that money. But software may be more important, and in fact, when we did our own analysis, we sort of broke it into a couple kinds of parts. One was issues that were very software related, like what operating systems are available, what language translators are available, what other things like loaders, assemblers, editors, this kind of thing are available. And then another parallel analysis was done from a hardware point of view. And in our case, we made the decision we made for both, as it turned out, for both reasons. Both of them leaned in the same direction, but my analysis, which was on the software side, I was convinced, almost no matter what the hardware said, it made an incredible difference because of what was available to me in the way of software tools. Let me just briefly recap what I've tried to say Basically, the problem is, can a mini be used effectively in a particular application? Why are we concerned about it? Because minis are cheap and they might be overused. But, as I said, I think more important because they've been used in limited ways and will tend to often be overlooked by people who just have not, for some reason or other, become familiar with them. The approach we take is to define a computing space, look to see where the application lies in that space, look to see where the mini environment, and then as a subsequent step, individual alternative vendor-supplied mini computers and peripherals lie in that space, and then look to see whether the application that we're concerned about lies in a coexistent point in that space.
Quite obviously, Dr. Diamond is a highly technical individual. His view of mini computers is perhaps more highly analytical than those of many neophyte users. Dan Diamond himself, at the time of this talk at NARUM in November 1971, admitted to having had only 14 months' experience in the small computer area. Most new minicomputer users will face the same sort of decision processes which Dan outlined for himself. For some, as apparently in Dan's case, software availability is a very important consideration. For others, service may be more important. For still others, price, and so forth. It seems that whatever your need for a complex logical device, there is a minicomputer, or perhaps an integrated circuit, which can be ordered to do the job cheaper than wiring circuits together yourself. The minicomputer and the integrated circuit are both witness to the decline of the electrical engineer as circuit builder and the continued rise of systems design and application as important and productive skills. Let us, in leaving, remind you that the description of products or services by participants in Soundings cassettes does not imply any form of endorsement by the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. Until next time, when we'll take a close look at new utilizations of military and aerospace technology, this is your editor, Walt Beam, thanking you for listening. IEEE Soundings is a registered service mark of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York.